Wallawanin Indawan, Nyaga Kirin, Nyaga Din Waniwandian. Hello, listeners. You're listening to Earth Matters, produced in the studios of 3CR on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country and broadcast across the continent via the Community Radio Network. My name's Kieran, and I'm your host for this episode. Today, I want to talk about climate change, about green capitalism, and about the lies of ethical consumption. Now, when we talk about climate change in the mainstream, we're told two things at the same time, two conflicting things. Firstly, that the crisis is urgent, which, you know, don't get me wrong, it is. But secondly, that nothing fundamental about how our society operates really needs to change. We are told that we can shop our way out of ecological collapse, that if we buy the right products, recycle correctly, offset our emissions, and wait patiently for a so-called transition, that everything will be fine. This is the core lie of green capitalism. Green capitalism exists as damage control. Green capitalism doesn't exist to stop environmental destruction. Instead, it exists to manage public anger about it. It's about keeping the same economic system running, the same extraction continuing, the same corporations in control, just with a green label attached. Fossil fuel companies rebrand themselves as energy companies. Mining giants rebrand themselves as critical mineral suppliers, and the banks rebrand as so-called climate leaders. Nothing, though, about the underlying logic ends up changing. Land is still something that can be exploited, water is still a resource to be priced, and communities are still treated as obstacles to someone's profit. A key part of this story is the myth of ethical consumption. Now, we're told that the problem is our behaviour, that it is our bins, our cars, our power bills and our shopping habits that are the issue. But the reality is that you cannot solve a systemic crisis through individual consumer choices. No amount of recycling offsets an economy that's built on planned obsolescence. No electric car fixes a system designed around endless growth and private ownership, and no personal lifestyle change can compete with the emissions of corporations that exist to maximize their shareholders' profit. Ethical consumption doesn't challenge power. All it does is seek to individualize responsibility while letting those with the real power offer the hook. Now, carbon offsets are one of the clearest examples of this. Offsets allow corporations and governments to continue polluting in the present by paying for theoretical reductions somewhere else. That somewhere else is often on indigenous land, or it's often in the global south, and it's often with questionable or unproven outcomes. It's a system that says destruction is acceptable as long as it's accounted for. But offsets don't stop harm. All they do is relocate it, delay it, or hide it behind spreadsheets and certification schemes. Recycling and net zero exist as distractions. People are encouraged to feel personally responsible for waste, while the vast majority of pollution doesn't come from the individual people. It comes from wars, it comes from industrial production, from packaging decisions, and from supply chains that consumers don't control. Net zero works the exact same way. It sounds ambitious, but in practice, it often means net destruction balanced out with creative accounting. These narratives keep people busy, busy sorting our bins and calculating our footprints. All the while, the system itself remains untouched. All the while, the US military continues to be the single biggest polluter in the world. And all the while, the top 100 corporations of the world are responsible for over 70% of the greenhouse gas emissions. And then there's the word transition. Now, transition implies movement, progress, a better future that's just around the corner. But in reality, the language of transition is often used to justify continued harm in the present. It means more mines now for a cleaner future later. More emissions now for a solution that's always just a few decades away. The crisis we are in is treated as temporary, but the damage that is happening is permanent. So when we hear governments and corporations talking about so-called green solutions, the first question we should ask is not, is this sustainable? The question we should ask is, who benefits? Who pays the cost? And whose land is being used to make it possible? Because once you actually ask those questions, the green gloss starts to peel away, and what's underneath looks a lot like the same old extraction. Because when we talk about green transition, the question isn't just what replaces fossil fuels, it's where the materials actually come from, whose land is taken to get those materials, and whose lives are treated as expendable in the process. And once you do follow that supply chain, the story becomes very clear. Renewables still require extraction. Whether it's solar panels, wind turbines, batteries, they all require large-scale mining. They all require stuff like lithium, cobalt, nickel, copper, and other rare earth minerals. There is no version of the current green transition that doesn't involve ripping enormous volumes of material out of the ground. The issue isn't technology. The issue is the fact that the same extractive logic is still being maintained. We haven't ended extraction. We've just changed the justifications for it. Here, in so-called Australia, lithium mining is being aggressively expanded and fast-tracked under the banner of climate responsibility. Projects in Western Australia and South Australia, projects out on Aboriginal land, are being framed as being in the national interest or essential for the global transition. But what this really actually means is that water systems are still under strain out there in already dry regions. It means destruction of country and sacred sites, and it means consultation processes that assume mining is inevitable. Communities aren't asked whether or not extraction should happen, they're asked how it should happen. And, you know, this is framed as consultation and consent, but it's really just coercion with better language. This creates what can only be described as green sacrifice zones. Places deemed acceptable to damage so that others, and when I say others, I mean those who are usually urban, wealthy, and living in distant communities to where this destruction is actually happening, those others can feel environmentally responsible. The people that are living with the poison water, with the land degradation, and with the cultural loss are told it's necessary, that the harm is unfortunate but unavoidable, that resisting is being irresponsible in the face of climate crisis. This is how colonial extraction has always worked, though. Climate just happens to be the new excuse. And if we follow that supply chain even further, the violence becomes even more explicit. Look, for example, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The extraction of cobalt and other critical minerals, which are essential for batteries and electric vehicles, is inseparable from mass death, displacement, and exploitation. Entire regions over there are locked into cycles of violence driven by global demand. Armed groups, child labour, forced labour, and ecological devastation are the structural features of how these minerals are obtained cheaply. This is the global economy functioning as it's designed, though. The neo-colonial and imperialist policies of the West at play. The so-called green transition in the global north is materially dependent on genocidal conditions elsewhere. So when the electric vehicles are marketed as being ethical, or when batteries are marketed as climate solutions, we have to ask, ethical for who? A solution for who? Clean energy for some is built on dirty violence for others. And the people paying the highest price are those who have already been subjected to centuries of extraction, colonialism, and dispossession. At the same time, we also see nature itself being turned into a commodity as it always has been for the last few hundred years now. We've got carbon markets, biodiversity credits, and soil carbon schemes. Instead of stopping destruction, we simply put a price on it. Instead of protecting country, we turn it into an asset. Land becomes a spreadsheet entry. Care becomes a contract, and those with capital gain new ways to control land that they do not belong to. So let's be clear about what's happening. The current green transition does not dismantle extractive capitalism. It does not center Indigenous sovereignty, and it does not redistribute power. What it does do is retools extraction so it can continue under some form of moral cover. And until we confront that honestly, climate action will keep reproducing the same violence, just with different victims and better branding. Climate policy is never neutral. Right now, the benefits of going green overwhelmingly flow upward. Subsidies for things like solar panels, electric vehicles, and home batteries are far more accessible to people who already own homes, who already have capital, and who already have stability. Meanwhile, poorer communities are more likely to live with heat stress and inadequate housing, more likely to rely on underfunded public transport, and more likely to be the ones working in industries being restructured without meaningful support. What we often see is privatized solutions instead of the collective infrastructure that we need. Electric vehicles are a perfect example of this. They're sold as a climate solution, but they reinforce a car-dependent system built around private ownership, sprawling cities, and enormous material demand. A generally just transition would prioritize things like public transport, like walkable communities, like shared infrastructure, and reduced energy demand, not just so-called cleaner consumption. Replacing every petrol car with an electric car doesn't challenge the system. It just changes the fuel source at the expense of innocent child slaves in the Congo. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Earth Matters, and today we're talking about climate change, green capitalism, and the lies of ethical consumption. So another point that I wanted to mention here is that we also hear a lot about green jobs. And, you know, don't get me wrong, while workers absolutely deserve secure, meaningful work, too often this promise is used to sell projects that primarily generate profits for corporations instead of long-term benefits for communities. You know, you've got your short construction booms, but they're often followed by automation, by fly-in and fly-out workforces, and by external ownership. Communities are left with the damage, while the profits move on elsewhere. A just transition would ask who owns the energy, who controls the work, and who actually decides what's built. Another really important thing I wanted to add onto this as well is that we can't have climate action without decolonization. This is the part that's often avoided and overlooked. There is no such thing as climate justice without decolonization. Any transition that we see that ignores Indigenous sovereignty, that treats land as a resource rather than country to be cared for, and that frames, you know, consent as consultation, will end up reproducing the same violence that created this crisis in the very first place. You know, because climate collapse didn't emerge in a vacuum. At the end of the day, it emerged from colonial extraction, from enclosure, and from the idea that land exists to be exploited. And we cannot solve the issue with the exact same worldview that caused it. And, you know, this is also, getting on a little bit of a tangent here, but this is also a criticism that I have of much of the activist community that resides across this continent. You know, we see thousands of settler progressives showing up to stuff like climate marches in the major cities and going to events like Rising Tide, where they block the shipment of coal. But where are these same activists when the land is actually being stolen? You know, where are these same activists when Indigenous communities are being displaced? Where are they when the minerals are being ripped out of the ground? Most of these activists wait until the destruction is already being undertaken or already finished before deciding to act. There is a very tiny, tiny minority who actually do show up and support First Nations activists and organisers who are actually out there on the front lines, who are actually out there fighting their displacement, fighting land clearing, fighting the construction of mines and the desecration of country, if people actually showed up in support before the minerals were even taken, before the mines were even constructed, before the land was even cleared for the mines, you know, before our communities were displaced so they could set up the mines and clear the land, then you'd stop the damage in the first place before it even had a chance to occur. You know, it's just, it's something that I've noticed over my last decade or so of organizing and activist work. You know, but back to what I was talking about, you know, what does a genuinely just transition actually require? You know, it would require stuff like land back and indigenous governance over land and water. It would require stuff like community-controlled energy instead of the corporate monopolies that we have. It would require stuff like reducing consumption in wealthy societies and not the endless growth mindset that we live under. It would require stuff like public investment into housing, into transport, into care. And it would require repair and not offsets. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, what I'm proposing here is the slower process. It's definitely a less profitable one, but it's something that directly challenges power. And that's why it's resisted at the end of the day, because it directly challenges those in power. It directly challenges those fossil fuel companies and those other mining companies that are reaping in billions of dollars. You know, in Australia alone, we export something like $450 billion in profits from mining and natural resources every single year, $500 billion nearly, every year in profits these companies make of ripping up the land and exploiting the minerals. And it's something that has been very much ongoing here for, you know, quite a long time now, since colonization, but it's something that only continues to get worse and worse every year. You know, the climate crisis isn't just an environmental problem either, it's a problem for everyone. One of my great mentors, Uncle Robbie Thorpe, talks a lot about this. He talks about genocide and ecocide equals suicide at the end of the day. You know, that's the mentality that we live under. People come in, they commit a genocide on the indigenous people. They continue to commit genocide, you know, in other places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo. They also add ecocide into it. And the end result for everybody, regardless of if you're indigenous or if you're non-indigenous, you know, regardless of what your ethnicity or nationality is, the end result is suicide for us all when we make a planet that's no longer habitable because of all the climate collapse and climate destruction and ecological collapse that we've been seeing and that we've been, you know, causing through the way that we're living. But yeah, you know, it's a question of who gets to live well at the end of the day as well. It's a question of who is sacrificed, of whose futures are treated as negotiable. And if the solution protects profits but not people, if it saves Western lifestyles but destroys lives, then it's not a solution at all. It's just more problems. So as we hear more and more about green growth and about clean transitions and net zero futures, the task isn't to ask whether they sound good, it's to ask whether or not they are just. Because the transition that leaves colonialism, extraction, and inequality intact isn't a transition forward, it's just the same system running on new fuel. And, you know, before we finish today as well, I want to be very clear about something. You know, I'm not saying all this because I want you to feel guilty. This isn't about guilt at the end of the day. And, you know, it's not about asking people to be better consumers either. Guilt is something that is paralyzing. And it individualizes a crisis that was never created by working class individuals in the first place. And it lets the real architects of environmental destruction stay comfortably out of frame. You know, what this is about responsibility. It's about shared collective responsibility. Now, responsibility doesn't mean carrying the blame for a system that you didn't design. I'm not saying that either. What I'm saying is, you know, responsibility means recognizing where you are positioned within it and what you do or what you don't accept as normal. So the question isn't, am I a good or am I a bad environmentalist? You know, the question is, what kind of future am I willing to help build? And who am I willing to stand with to do it? Collective responsibility starts with refusing the stories that we're sold. It starts with refusing the idea that endless extraction can be made ethical, refusing the idea that justice can be offset, outsourced or delayed, and refusing the idea that some people in some places are acceptable to losses. It means shifting our attention away from individual purity and toward collective power. Power looks like communities organizing against destructive projects. Power looks like supporting Indigenous struggles for land, for water, and for sovereignty. It looks like our unions, our neighborhoods, and our movements demanding public solutions instead of private fixes. You know, don't get me wrong, not everyone can do everything, but no one is asking that. Everyone can do something that connects them to others. Whether it be paying attention to whose land projects are being built on, or listening when communities say no, or showing up when resistance is being criminalized, or backing movements that challenge extraction at its root, not just the image of extraction. You know, a just future, at the end of the day, isn't something that will be built by perfect individuals making ethical choices in isolation. It's something that will be built by imperfect people acting together, challenging power together, redistributing resources, and refusing to accept a system that treats life as expendable. So if there's one thing to take away from today, let it be this. Climate justice isn't about feeling bad, it's about standing on the right side of struggle. And there's something we can only do and only ever do if we do it together. So if you have been listening today, if you do feel compelled to do something, anything, even if it's just to educate yourself some more, I do have some recommendations. Locally here in so-called Australia, you can look into organisations like Seed Mob, who is a First Nations-led climate justice network, which actively campaigns against fossil fuels, destructive mining, and these false climate solutions. There's Original Power, which supports Indigenous communities to build community-controlled energy, not corporate green projects that are imposed on our country. There's the Environment Centre in the NT. They do a lot of strong work opposing fracking, mining and water destruction in the NT, and they consistently collaborate with the traditional owners up there. This next one is especially useful for regional and rural listeners. That's the Lock the Gate Alliance. They're a grassroots alliance who are resisting mining, gas and fracking. And if you want a bit of an example of what stuff could actually look like, there's the Martawarra Fitzroy River Council, which is a really powerful example of Indigenous-led governance resisting extractive projects and asserting custodianship over water systems. Now, internationally, I mentioned the Democratic Republic of the Congo before. If you want to learn a bit more about that, you can look into the Friends of the Congo, which is one of the most important organizations that are exposing the link between cobalt, rare earths, war, and mass exploitation in the Congo. There's RAID, R-A-I-D. They focus on corporate accountability in African mining sectors, including supply chains which are tied to EVs and batteries. There's also organizations like AfroWatch and Enough Project, and they, you know, investigate stuff like the links between global markets, armed violence and resource extraction, and they do a lot of documenting of abuse on the ground in terms of these mining companies coming in using child labour and forced labour. But, you know, this is just a really short list, though, that I'm giving. At the end of the day, no matter where you're listening to this show, I'm sure you can find something in your local area as well. If not, you know, reach out to your local First Nations community, see what they're doing, see what they're fighting for, because most communities are fighting some form of land clearing or extraction or water pollution or threat to sacred sites, or, you know, the list goes on and on. If there isn't anything local, start something. And, you know, I really want to stress that. If you don't have a local campaign or project going on, be the one to start it. Get together with your friends, get together with your colleagues or your neighbours or other like-minded people in the community and start something, anything. Even if it's just a fundraiser to help support something, you know, in your local area or beyond, somewhere else on the continent or even elsewhere in the world. And I want to stress that, you know, these aren't about easing guilt or buying our way out. They're about backing people who are already resisting extraction, who are already protecting land, and who are already building alternatives, And, you know, most of the time, they're doing it at great personal cost. They're doing it without funding. They're doing it without being paid for it. And, you know, they could really use the support of like-minded people in the community. Want to give a quick shout-out to our supporters at the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
Makarta. Lady Blue, feel the waves in my hair, so calm and cool. Perfect, no despair, I wish I could swim here forever, Miss Lady Blue. Me and you, run, run down the way that we go. Pulling up, picking up the sand in our toes. Pass down the whistling trees. Lady Blue, she is calling me. Her soul is pure, clearer than a crystal in the moon. And I believe that she told the truth, cause ever since, my heart is in the sea. Run, run down the way that we go. Pulling up, picking up the sand in our toes. Pass down the whistling trees. Lady Blue, she is calling me. Miss Lady.